Ani, and welcome back to the show. This is Indigenous Waves on CIUT 89.5. You were just listening to Young Eagle Cree Drum Group. That track was in Intertribal. From Young Eagle Cree, we are going to be speaking with Chelsea Vowell about this Supreme Court of Canada ruling that was handed down last week, and I think she's on the phone with us. Hello, Chelsea.
Tansi.
My apologies for our late start today. We had technical difficulties in the studio.
No worries at all.
Sorry about that. So if we could start with your initial sort of thoughts on the ruling last week.
I'm a deeply cynical person. So I just wanna be honest about my approach to this, is that I don't think it's the wonderful game changer that a lot of people are saying it is. It's a bit better than I expected. So I'll try to be positive now that I'm that I'm admitting that. This was a really interesting case because there's been a lot of fear since Delgamuukw that once they actually did find Aboriginal title somewhere, that we were going to find out that Aboriginal title under Canadian common law was only going to be small, tiny little postage stamp areas where people had settled almost permanently, or at least semi-permanently, mm-hmm. and that it wouldn't extend to wider territories. So this sort of puts that fear to rest. The fact that it extended to areas that were heavily used beyond just where people settled is really a big deal. It speaks a lot to what's possible now for areas that are not covered by treaties that dealt with land. It amazes me that it's taken this long to find Aboriginal title since Delgamuukw. So I sort of felt it was never going to happen. So I'm a little excited about that. What else can I say? It's still one of the interesting things in that judgment was the fact that I'm not even sure why they brought it up, but the court said that terra nullius has never applied in Canada. So this idea that you can just, that Indigenous peoples didn't really, weren't here enough to lay any claim to the land, that's been struck down completely. But the judgment also never spoke to how Canada achieved, sovereignty or radical underlying title over the land in the first place.
Yes, yeah.
There's this sort of, and this is the elephant in the room, mm-hmm. That of course Canada is really loath to discuss and justify. We know many different ways that have been struck down, many different ways that don't work. I mean, there's no doctrine of conquest here. There's no conquest in Canada, right? So they didn't achieve the land, didn't get the land through conquest. And terra nullius, so the doctrine of discovery as well, just discovering the land isn't enough. So what gave Canada the land? Why are they still there underneath the Aboriginal title? And I think that's the part we have to be careful about, because we didn't really know when they finally decided how, when they were going to determine Aboriginal title, how that was going to work. Would there be sort of this, is Aboriginal title going to be just it? Is this going to be this little enclave of Aboriginal land that no longer, that Canada has no claim to whatsoever? Well, of course, the court refused to take that position. They said that they're still cradling Aboriginal title underneath. Mm-hmm. And what's ironic about this is that the very fact of that underlying radical title that the Crown claims they have gives rise to this fiduciary duty, they say, to deal fairly with the First Nation and it speaks to a power imbalance, right? You only have a fiduciary obligation to somebody who relies on you. When you have power over someone, you have to treat them in a certain way, like a doctor to a patient. So they say that having this underlying title creates that fiduciary obligation. But in the next breath, they're talking about how they also have to balance Canadian interests, and whenever there's a project that is compelling and necessary for the public, that they have a series of steps that they can go through to infringe on Aboriginal title. So the one hand giveth and the other taketh away.
Yeah, that seems to be sort of what people are talking about right now, is the pros and the cons of this ruling. And you touched on a lot of what I'm going to ask you about in that opening question. You mentioned the move from specific settlement sites to recognizing Aboriginal title on larger geographical areas of territory. Is that, my question here is, they established that the Shilkotin had quote-unquote exclusive occupation of their lands. Mm-hmm. So what my question is, what about nations that do not have exclusive occupation of their lands in the sense that they have overlapping territories with other nations?
Yeah, that definitely complicates things. I think there was a brief nod to indigenous treaty making, between nations in the decision, but I think that needs to be clarified too, because that's really the situation in BC. There's so much overlapping territory. So it wouldn't make sense to say, okay, this one group has Aboriginal title in an area where they're, you know, they're sharing territory. So there's got to be a different approach to it that takes into account the ability of nations to enter into treaty with one another to share resources, mm-hmm. right? So you would think that Aboriginal title, if it were found in an area of overlapping, territory or occupation, that they would have to modify the test for this a little bit to take into account the fact that, if it fits the criteria in every other way, there's heavy use, sufficient use, the lack of exclusivity shouldn't work against nations, right? Like it's a good thing that yeah. people are sharing resources and managing territories together. So I think that's something that seems kind of common sense, that if the issue comes up, I can't see them saying, well, you guys were sharing this place for thousands of years, but that because the thing in this judgment too, the Chief Justice really clarifies the fact that we can't, when you're trying to translate Aboriginal practices into modern-day rights, you can't just do it through a common law lens. You can't take a European view of property or even exclusivity, just like this, here's my fence and you can't come on here, thus this is my property. You can't do that. You've got to look at Aboriginal practices as they occurred, and Native people share lands, share territories, create treaties with one another, and that has to be recognized. And then somehow put into a framework or understood through the common law so that it can give rise to modern day rights. That's the court saying that. I think that approach is ridiculous. Like I think that we need to look at how, look at our own indigenous orders. It has the answers. We don't need to be sort of squeezing it. Not, they say don't put it into a box of common law, but we are sort of warping it as we're trying to translate it into common law principles.
Right. So. In terms of the issue of the duty to consult, and you mentioned this as well prior, the fiduciary duty that was mentioned, the fact that development can go forward if it meets one of these two conditions. So I'm not sure if you saw, but Pamela Parmenter, who I'm sure you're familiar with, a lawyer and activist, stated, and this is a quote, "So it's not just about the duty to consult anymore. This really changes it to a requirement to get consent over all unceded territory in this country." Do you agree with that, Chelsea?
Well, okay. The way that it's going to work, in my opinion, is not that consent is going to be required. There is now, before Aboriginal title is proven, once it's asserted, before it's proven, that assertion of Aboriginal title is enough to trigger the duty to consult, right? And the onus is higher, because duty to consult exists on a spectrum. It's, how much impact is this development going to have on the lands or the Aboriginal rights that are being practiced in that area? If the impact is foreseen as minimal, then it's minimal consultation. They drive by, throw out some pamphlets, there you go, right? If it's something that's serious, that really impacts the area, then they have to do more consultation. Now, consent to the First Nation isn't like this court decision did not say that you need consent before Aboriginal title is proven. It might get up to that point if the impact is really strong enough. Okay, that might exist on the spectrum if whatever project is being proposed could seriously alter the landscape. But once Aboriginal title is proven, then consent is needed. And that's the kicker here, because we've never really been given that before but the court has never said, you guys have the right to say no. But at the same time, once you have Aboriginal title and you have to give consent, if you refuse to give consent, then that triggers the whole Section 35 test where there's justifiable infringement. So you can say no, and they're like, okay, you've said no, you haven't given us your consent. Now we have to go through this process to infringe on your rights anyway. So it's a stronger right once you've proven Aboriginal title, which is hard to do. I mean, this took a really, really long time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's risky. You know, they only got 5% of the area they're claiming. Like, you got to keep that in mind, 5%. Mm-hmm. And if you did that throughout BC and everybody got 5% of what they were claiming, you know, you would have a good two-thirds of the province still left open to, you know, with minimal need to consult anybody. So it's not the greatest situation.
Yeah. When you mentioned, you know, that the sort of underlying crown title, the terra nullius, the ruling stating that terra nullius, the doctrine of terra nullius was never applied in Canada, and all of these things, it made me think a little bit about terminology. And I have to say that I saw this on Facebook from Murray Sinclair, but we have seen this week in mainstream media reporting that the Supreme Court decision, quote unquote, granted title to the Shilkotin on their territory.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, Chelsea, if you've noticed this, and if so, do you see it as a sort of a technique of maintaining the authority of the crown? Or is it simply a lack of understanding of an Indigenous inherent rights by the mainstream media?
I think it's both intentional and unintentional at the same time, because it flows from a worldview wherein Canada does not question how it's, you know, suddenly became owner of all the lands, right? It's just accepted as true in the common law. It's a legal fiction that underpins the entire system, mm-hmm. right? You can't have Canadian politics, you can't have a Canadian legal system, you don't have any socio-political order here whatsoever, unless you accept that legal fiction is true. So, of course, when they talk about things, they're granting, they're giving, they're recognizing, right? Because they have to believe that underneath everything is Canada, is the power of Canada, the sovereignty that lies under everything. You know, things are only a burden on the underlying power of Canada, right? So it's, you know, the people who are within those processes, who are in the judiciary, who are, you know, within the political system, they have to speak that way. And whether they even notice that they're speaking that way is irrelevant, because it's part and parcel of the power that they're claiming. I do think, however, that sometimes it is intentional. I think that because there has been a lot of pressure put out lately by people, Indigenous people, who are saying, you know, look, we have our own socio-political orders, we have our own legal orders. Those laws are still, you know, in place and being practiced, and so you're not giving us anything that we don't already have. And there's pushback against that, because it threatens Canada. It threatens Canada to the core. It's the very existence. So, I think that people are aware of that, the fear of that Indigenous authority that still exists, that's never been extinguished or released or ceded or surrendered or all of the other words that they use to say you don't have this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think that in some cases those words are chosen very carefully to make us feel like we're, you know, they're being generous with us, instead of dealing with the fact that we're plenty aware that there really is no legal standing for them to claim underlying title or sovereignty to the land.
Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of shows where we've had guests who are very critical of the comprehensive land claims process, the self-government agreements. It's something that we're very conscious of at this show. So I'm wondering, as someone very well-versed in law, what do you see as the implications for the nations who are currently participating in those negotiation tables?
Well, one of the things that people have been talking about since this decision is, here's one of the game-changing things, is that now, you know, this is the first time Aboriginal title has been found to exist. There was just the possibility of it before. All modern land claims rely on extinguishment, on the surrender of lands. That's just sort of, you know, a starting point for these sorts of negotiations, is you give up any claim to Aboriginal title in exchange for, you know, money or this or that or whatever, which is, yeah, you're they're giving you what you already have, but do that. Now there's the possibility of, instead of saying, okay, look, we're you know, getting rid of Aboriginal title right off the bat, why can't we find for Aboriginal title in this process? Why can't we say, look, let's not go through the expensive $40 million court case. Let's just say, let's agree, this area is ours and we have our Aboriginal title. That's absolutely something that can be done through these comprehensive claims.
Okay.
And I think, unfortunately, that's going to be a bit more attractive now. And I say unfortunately because this case so clearly laid out the possibility of infringement, right? So there's less to lose for Canada now. If these groups negotiate for Aboriginal title, Canada can still hold in their hearts, look, we get to infringe if we need to, right? I think that needs to change. I think the people need to step back and think about how this case affects their negotiations and maybe come at it from a little bit different angle now.
Well, that sort of leads into my last question for you, Chelsea. Is the Supreme Court or Canadian lower courts, if that happens, the only way for us to establish Aboriginal title on our traditional territories? Like, if we don't go to court, does Canada by default get ownership of lands, you know, where Aboriginal title has not been established by their courts? Like, this is a question I've sort of been grappling with over the last, you know, week.
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that Aboriginal title only exists within Canadian common law. It's not a concept that comes from Indigenous laws. The reciprocal obligations that nations have to the territories that they're in, you can't translate that, right? That's a legal relationship that nations have with their territory that have existed before Canada ever came along and continue to exist. So that's completely separate. If you're looking for Aboriginal title, you have to get it recognized by Canada because they're the ones who came up with it, right? So if you want Canada to recognize it, yeah, you got to go through the courts. But if you want to exercise it, then you have to go through your own laws, right? Yeah. And of course, Canada is going to say, well, we don't care about your laws; it's ours anyway, right? But we're facing that across the board when it comes to any of our rights. Is Canada saying, well, you don't actually have those rights until we say you do? But that's assuming that we accept their legal order, that we accept their sovereignty, that we accept their legal fictions. And I think more and more people are not doing that. But we're not going to get recognition from Canada. They're not going to say, hey, no problem, call it whatever you want, and we'll treat it like Aboriginal title. They're going to want to have something to say about that. So, yeah.
I hear that. I really do. And those are pretty, I mean, those are important questions that we have to ask ourselves as we go forward. You know, what exactly do we want to do and how do we want to proceed? Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate you being on the show today, Chelsea. Once again, thanks for joining Indigenous Waves. And you had a lot of great insights. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Take care. We were just speaking with Chelsea Vowell about the Supreme Court of Canada ruling that was that came down last week in the Shilcotin-Williams land case. We're going to go